Good afternoon. Welcome to the Ropes and Gray Teleconference, Washington, D.C. Updates and Insights on Life Sciences and Healthcare. I will now turn it over to our moderator, Al Kokoza.
Thank you, Jeanette. Hello, and thank you for joining our teleconference this afternoon. I'm Al Kokoza, a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Ropes and Gray, and a member of the firm's Life Sciences Practice Group. This teleconference is part of our ongoing Capital Insights series, where we are capturing our latest thinking on developments from the federal government that might affect our clients. In this case, regulatory and compliance issues in 2019 of particular interest to life sciences and healthcare companies. Our Capital Insights page at www.ropesgray.com includes alerts, analyses, and podcasts, and we invite you to continue to visit that page throughout 2019. Joining me again today are several of my colleagues from the D.C. office. Tom Bullitt from our healthcare practice group, Kelly Combs, Greg Levine, and Beth Weinman from the life sciences practice group, and Colleen Conray with our litigation and enforcement practice group. Welcome back, everyone, and welcome to Beth, who recently joined our firm from the FDA Office of Chief Counsel. Over the next hour, we will look to give you insights into critical developments we see emerging in 2019. But at the outset, we cannot ignore the key current issue, the government shutdown, now over 1 month old. Suffice it to say, it is an unprecedented, unpredictable, and dynamic situation. And by the way, anyone who tells you they know when the shutdown will end does not know when the shutdown will end. First, much of HHS, including CMS and NIH, are not shut down because the HHS appropriations bill was enacted earlier in 2018. But FDA, even though it is part of HHS, for historical reasons, gets its funding through the Agriculture Appropriations Bill, and that bill was not enacted in time. From an FDA perspective, the agency is not allowed to spend appropriated funds during the shutdown. But, in fact, user fees are not considered appropriated funds. So the agency can spend the user fees collected prior to the shutdown to run certain operations. Reports indicate that 2018 reserve user fees, at least from the PDUFA program, will run out sometime in early to mid-February. In addition, FDA is not allowed to collect any user fees during the shutdown and therefore cannot accept any applications that require a user fee. Commissioner Gottlieb has been juggling his available resources to target essential activities deemed to, quote, address imminent threats to the safety of human life, but it's unclear how long his current resources will last. Even in those essential situations, employees who are called back to work are working without pay. Finally, once the shutdown ends, there likely will be a rush of applications filed that could create a backlog that FDA will have to work through in 2019. Let's turn from the shutdown to today's conversation that will be informed by a combination of publicly available statements, past behavior, and general trends we have observed in the life sciences and healthcare industries, and of course, some element of educated speculation. As you can all appreciate, however, given the results of the 2018 midterm elections and what appears to be the early start of the 2020 presidential campaign, it is unclear what, if anything, will be accomplished legislatively this year, although there still may be room for executive action. We plan to save time at the end of the teleconference to address questions from our listeners. If you have questions during the teleconference, please email them to rgevents@ropesgray.com. Again, rgevents@ropesgray.com. And we will try to get as many to as many as we can. One further note, we are offering CLE credit for this teleconference, and I will provide you with the necessary information to receive such credit at the end of the teleconference. So now let's begin with Tom Bullitt from our healthcare practice. Tom, you spent 2017 watching very closely the efforts of Congress and the Trump administration to repeal and replace the Obama administration's significant domestic achievement, or signature domestic achievement, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. You even wrote a monthly column for Bloomberg BNA on the subject. I suppose everyone knows what the Congress failed to repeal the ACA that year. Were there important ACA developments in 2018 that continue to be of interest to our healthcare stakeholders in 2019?
Thanks, Al. The only legislative accomplishment on Obamacare was the tax cut bill passed in December of 2017, which for ACA purposes reduced the tax penalty for failure to have Obamacare-compliant health insurance to zero starting this year. That led to a lawsuit by some state attorneys general to have the entire ACA declared unconstitutional because the theory goes with the tax removed, the individual mandate can no longer stand as an exercise of Congress's taxing powers, and the individual mandate is so essential to the rest of the ACA that the entire act has to fall. A Texas U.S. district judge agreed with that but has stayed his decision pending appeal. The issue will certainly end up in the Supreme Court, but the ACA will continue at least for this year. It's worth noting that if the ACA were to fall, it would strike down not just the law's insurance reforms and Medicaid expansion, but a variety of programs that were enacted as part of the ACA, including the pathway for FDA approval of biosimilars and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, CMMI, that has launched many of the federal value-based healthcare initiatives, such as the Medicare Shared Savings Program for Accountable Care Organization and the Bundled Payments for Care Improvement Initiative. Obamacare signups in the 39 states using the federalhealthcare.gov platform were down this year by about 4%. We still don't have all the data on state signups, but it looks like there will still be about 10 million who are signed up through the exchanges and another 17 million through the expansion of Medicaid. One of the things that the Trump administration has done that could be significant is to expand the availability of non-Obamacare compliant plans by promulgating final regulations allowing short-term plans, which can now last for a year and be renewed, and association health plans, which will allow unrelated entities in the same area of business to be treated as a single employer. And CMS has also recently suggested that states may be able to obtain ACA waivers, allowing them to make subsidy dollars available to individual buying one of these non-ACA compliant plans. The result is, as I and a lot of others predicted last year, fewer people will have comprehensive insurance, putting more pressure on hospitals and other providers to deal with the uninsured. But so far, effects have been marginal.
Thank you, Tom. Let's turn to another topic, value-based health care. Since the arrival of the new HHS Secretary Alex Azar, has there been more favorable movement in the area of value-based health care than under prior Secretary Tom Price? Will you remind us of what value-based health care means and catch us up on what's happening in that topic?
Well, value-based health care means paying for quality outcomes rather than quantity of procedures. Both HHS and the private sector have been pursuing this agenda since Secretary Price's departure and Secretary Azar's arrival. A significant event demonstrating some of the government's position on this is an OIG advisory opinion from September that allowed a medical device seller to offer a warranty equal to the aggregate purchase price of three products in a product suite that wouldn't have been protected by the warranty safe harbor to the anti-kickback law, and in doing that said some favorable things about manufacturer guarantees like that. In 2018, OIG also put out three notable requests for information, soliciting public comment on ways to reduce impediments to value-based care under the anti-kickback statute, the Stark Law, and HIPAA. Many groups, including Pharma and AdvaMed, submitted comments. The noise we are hearing is that HHS is favorably inclined towards doing something to make it easier for drug and device makers to stand behind their product's performance, though as of now, there have been no new regulations. CMS has rolled out a new Bundled Payments for Care Improvement Advanced initiative. This one is an improvement, or at least a change from the prior program. The biggest change is that for BPCI Advanced, participants will now have to share downside risk in order to participate. Probably the biggest value-based change also feeds into the next area that I think of as importance, prescription drug pricing. We've seen drug makers and payers explore innovative ways to pay for expensive specialty drugs. There's Bluebird Bio's proposed five-year installment plan, where the payer would make annual payments contingent on the drug's effectiveness, and Louisiana's proposal to enter into a Netflix model arrangement with a hepatitis C drug maker, where the state would pay an annual subscription fee for unlimited access to the drug. Maybe the most surprising development in 2018 came from CMS, which has proposed a mandatory demonstration project for half of Medicare Part B that would use international reference pricing as the basis for payment for drugs administered in physician offices. The current system virtually guarantees doctors a markup on drugs they purchase and administer under a statutory formula. In the new system, if this goes through, beginning in the spring of 2020, doctors would no longer buy and bill. Intermediaries would bid to become contractors to buy the drug to be supplied to the doctor office and would be paid at the international reference pricing rate. By the way, we maintain a website on value-based healthcare at ropesandgray.com with a number of the resources in this area that listeners can access.
Thank you, Tom. You have now basically set up the next area of questions, which is around prescription drug pricing. You know, in the many years I've been practicing law here in D.C., I have never seen so much attention by policymakers across the spectrum to the subject of prescription drug pricing. As you may remember, candidate Trump accused drug companies of getting away with murder. He's continued that rhetoric, but in 2018, he really turned up the heat. His administration issued a blueprint in the spring of 2018 that addressed several areas where the administration intended to take steps to reduce the amount that payers and patients have to pay for drugs. Can you catch us up on those developments, Tom?
Yeah, my experience is the same as yours. It's been a remarkable year for rhetoric on prescription drug prices. But apart from the Medicare Part B demonstration that I mentioned, which is still just proposed, little real action at the federal level. Some of the federal initiatives that are unlikely, I think, to have more than a marginal impact on drug pricing include proposing that manufacturers disclose a drug's list price in television ads, allowing step therapy for Part B drugs covered by Medicare Advantage plans, proposing that Part D plans can exclude certain protected class drugs from their formularies, convening a working group to study drug importation, and signing legislation to ban gag clauses on pharmacists, which in theory would have prevented pharmacists from advising patients of lower-cost products. A number of states have also enacted price transparency laws aimed at requiring drug makers to disclose their prices and price increases, and a whole bunch of states whose legislative sessions have just started have already introduced new bills that would begin to regulate drug pricing transparency and in some cases would attempt to regulate drug price increases. And lastly, the 340B drug discount program continues to be a source of dispute. Providers and drug makers each have long accused the other of failing to live up to the program's purposes. Most recently, the Trump administration has sought to reduce 340B reimbursement to providers by nearly 30%, but a federal court recently enjoined the cuts. It'll be interesting to see what 2019 has in store for the long-running controversy around that program.
Thank you, Tom, for that detailed discussion of the various pricing and value-based issues. Let's turn now to FDA. Kelly Combs, Greg Levine, and Beth Wyman will address these issues. And Greg, let's start with you. I know you spend a lot of time on FDA device matters, so let's focus on that sector. For example, yesterday, FDA published on its website, rather than the Federal Register, which is affected by the shutdown, final guidance on a new safety and performance-based pathway for 510K devices, and also issued a request for comments on a proposal to publish a list of devices that were 510K cleared based on comparisons to quote-unquote older predicate devices. What's the urgency on these issues, and what are the prospects for success in 2019?
Yeah, thanks, Al. I was interested in that. On the face of that guidance document, when they publish it, they do have a note on there explicitly that says that they did not put a notice in the Federal Register because of the shutdown. And the reason is because they're required by their good guidance practice regulations to publish a notice of availability of the guidance in the Federal Register and to publish it on their website at the same time. So they're sort of explicitly acknowledging that they're not following their rules, but they can't, and so that they'll publish that notice, presumably as soon as they are able to do so. But I think the reason that they wanted to push this out anyway is because of the context of what's been going on with devices, and in particular this kind of broader trend that we saw through much of 2018, where the FDA leadership and the leadership of the Device Center and Commissioner Gottlieb himself have increasingly emphasized device safety, both pre-market and post-market with devices. On the pre-market side, for around a decade, the primary focus, both at FDA and in Congress, has been on improving the timeliness and consistency of the FDA review process, and in particular, in the 510K process, where a lot of the most device reviews, pre-market reviews, happen. And there's been a lot of criticism, and I think a pretty widely held view, that since around 2009, when a lot of these issues started being looked at pretty seriously, that there was a lack of consistency in device reviews, that device reviews often focused on relevant questions, that many reviews were therefore overly burdensome, and that we then had delayed introduction of devices to the U.S. market and made the U.S. market increasingly unattractive for device innovation and investment. And but in 2018, it seems that the pendulum, in my view, began swinging pretty hard the other way, both in the U.S. And in Europe as well. And a couple of events, I think, may have precipitated that, first in the spring and then again in November. First there was a film documentary and then a series of print and TV and internet news stories that broke both in the U.S. and also in Europe. And these focused on cases in which marketed devices were allegedly associated with adverse reactions. Many of those devices involve women's health, such as gynecological devices and contraceptive implants. And these really weren't new stories, or some were frankly pretty old. For example, there were stories about metal on metal hips and other things that had been, you know, known for years. Some of these devices have been off the market for years, in fact. But I think a lot of it was the manner in which these were publicized, like this Netflix documentary, the particular focus on regulators. I mean, they had interviews with people like David Kessler speaking out, former FDA commissioner speaking out about alleged deficiencies in the regulatory process for medical devices. Those things were somewhat novel, and they seemed to have captured the attention of the FDA and regulators overseas as well. Another potentially significant development on this side of the pond anyway is November 2018, we had the Democrats take over the House of Representatives in Congress, and that means I think we can expect to see heightened oversight of the executive branch of government. And there's no reason to think that the FDA is going to be an exception to that. And so in this environment, it's not surprising to see the FDA emphasizing increasingly a commitment to device safety. In addition, at the same time, it's continuing to work on the efforts to improve the efficiency of the device review process. And many of the efforts that it has underway and in process in that area, it has to do, has been mandated by Congress under a series of laws that 21st Century Cures Act, enacted in 2016, medical device user fee reauthorization law that was part of the FDARA that was enacted in 2017. So it's got a lot of things that have been in process and it has to continue working on to sort of improve and speed up that device review process. So it's continuing to work on those things, but you see increasingly efforts by the FDA to focus on device safety as well. So there were a number of things throughout the year. In April, just a few days before that documentary came out, we saw the FDA publish a medical device safety action plan that had a number of elements to it. It talked about working with the National Evaluation System for Health Technology, or NEST, to enhance active surveillance and signal detection by using electronic health records and systems and these UDI, unique device identifiers on device labeling to try to associate adverse reactions with devices in the real world, and the potential ability of the FDA to streamline the imposition of post-market device safety mitigations when adverse reactions are observed with devices without having to go through notice and comment rulemaking to do so, and then potentially spurring innovation towards safer medical devices, such as by adopting an expanded version of the abbreviated 510K program, to increase the use of consensus standards for bringing new devices to market rather than comparing new devices to older predicate devices. I mentioned that in November, there was this series of news articles and TV programs and other things that ran both in the U.S. and Europe. And similarly, as in April, just a few days before those things started running, the FDA came out with an update to its safety action plan. And here the FDA announced sort of an ambitious new goal for device safety and said that its goal was to ensure that the FDA is consistently first among the world's regulatory agencies to identify and act upon safety signals related to medical devices. The FDA, again, emphasized that it's going to try to use active surveillance techniques, talked about its budget request to the administration. Well, that's, you know, a little bit held up now, that's where we are with the budget for that program, and some other things it had underway with particular emphasis on women's health and some of these other kinds of devices that, you know, we'd heard about in some of these stories. And then in November, and then a few days later in November, the FDA came out with an announcement that it wanted to modernize the 510K pathway with a particular emphasis on movement towards more modern predicate devices. So the FDA said that the most impactful way we can promote innovation and improve safety in the 510K program is to drive innovators towards reliance on more modern predicate devices or objective performance criteria, and that to promote the use of more modern, more recent predicates, FDA would consider publishing a list of cleared devices, so marketed devices, that had demonstrated substantial equivalence, so had gotten through the 510K process, by comparing themselves to predicate devices that were more than 10 years old. And I'm, for time reasons, I'm going to have to skip through a lot of the details on that, but suffice it to say, this was extremely controversial when it was announced. In fact, the very next day, the commissioner of the FDA felt the need to come out with another press statement of his own, sort of justifying why he felt this was important, and sort of talking further about this and why older predicates might not reflect the newest performance standards, might not have the latest features related to cybersecurity or biocompatibility or other kind of important features. So in the announcement, the two items that came out yesterday, the first was the safety and performance-based pathway, which was a new name the FDA gave to that expanded abbreviated 510K program that they had announced months before. That's the final guidance where instead of comparing your device to a predicate device, to an older device, you would instead compare your device to a set of performance criteria that would be identified by the FDA. And the FDA, in theory, is going to have to, on a device type by device type basis, issue guidance documents that identify a set of objective performance criteria that would be reflective of devices currently on the market. And instead of comparing your device to a particular device on the market, you would show your device meets these objective criteria, and that's how you would get your device on the market. And clearly, the FDA thinks that that's a better way to go. The one among many criticisms of this program is very burdensome to do. How do you come up with these performance criteria? Is it really going to happen? Is it realistic? So there's lots of questions about that. So that's, but that's now final guidance, although it didn't really follow FDA's good guidance practices. And then the other thing that FDA came out with yesterday, which ordinarily would be in the Federal Register but wasn't, was a call for comments on this idea of publishing a list of older predicates, which is this kind of, you know, I don't see any alternative but to see this as sort of a naming and shaming thing. We're going to come out with a list of devices that are on the market based on a comparison to predicates that are more than 10 years old. This is a concept. And FDA says, well, we're not saying that everything that's more than 10 years old is necessarily bad. There may be devices that are older that don't need innovation. They don't need to be newer. They're old, established technologies that are perfectly fine. But anyway, they've come out with a series of four questions about, you know, whether this is a good idea or not, and if it's not 10 years, what should it be, and how do we identify them, and so forth. And so they've asked for comments on by April 22nd on their series of questions about this. It's on the website. They say on the website, they say, please submit comments by April 22nd. According to the attached instructions, when you look at the instructions, it says you must comment by April 22nd. So it's a little unclear whether that has any binding force to it, given that it's not actually in the Federal Register. So that's where that stands.
Thanks, Greg. It sounds like 2019 is going to be a very busy year in the device sector. Can you give us a high-level overview? Another device topic that's come up is the rapidly developing field of digital health, and in particular, the progress FDA has made on its pre-certification pilot program that it initiated in 2017. A number of Democratic senators raised questions about FDA's legal authority to even implement that pre-certification program. Can you give us a high-level overview of what the latest thinking is in that area?
Yeah, I'll make this one very short because the FDA came out with an announcement earlier this month to say that they're moving from the first stage of the pilot program. So they started a pilot program in 2017 with 9 companies to look at this idea of pre-certification, which was kind of undefined, which is we're going to pre-certify certain companies and show that they're going to do an excellence criteria and that they're excellent companies at developing software as a medical device. It's limited to software that itself serves as a medical device, and that if you're in this program, there's going to be some streamlined benefit to it. There's going to be some streamlining of the regulatory process for that kind of software. But what that would be was unclear, what the criteria, everything about it was unclear. And so these 9 companies would help sort of develop the program in its entirety. So that kind of development phase, you know, they worked through that. They came up with this, what they called a working model. Now they're moving from that phase into the testing phase. And so this year, 2019, they're going to start testing out how this thing actually might work. And so they've come out with a testing plan. They actually came out with 3 documents. The first is, one of them is a testing plan. One is an update of the model to sort of walk through what it will contain. And the third, very interestingly, is a regulatory framework for conducting the pilot program within current authorities, which clearly is a response to these concerns and criticisms raised about whether they have legal authority to do pre-certification. So essentially what they said is, for now, the only things we're going to do will fall within our current legal authority. To the extent we do anything, it's going to be under the de novo program. So companies can submit, it's still the 9 companies in the pilot program. They can submit, they can do submissions under the de novo, they can do de novo device submissions for software. And then the FDA is going to do this comparison. They're trying to come up with a streamlined form of de novo submission. And so they're then going to do a hypothetical, their test is going to be a hypothetical pre-cert de novo versus a traditional de novo. But the devices that come to market under that thing, or under that program, in the real world are going to have to go through traditional. So you don't actually get a break if you're in this pilot testing program this year in 2019. It's a test to see what the benefit is. And then they're also going to try to show and validate that it actually provides the same level of safety and effectiveness assurance to the public health to do the streamlined versus the traditional. And they're going to do some other testing as well, that they're the way that they establish the, what do they call it, the excellence appraisal, that's a good process as well. So 2019 is going to be another year of testing under this pilot program.
Sounds like 2019 is going to be a very busy year in the device sector. Thanks for that thorough discussion, Greg. I'm now going to turn it over to Kelly Combs so we can talk about drugs and biologics. And in that area, what about biosimilars, Kelly? What's the current landscape for biosimilars? Any significant regulatory developments for biosimilars in store for 2019?
Yes, absolutely. So FDA Commissioner Gottlieb has been extremely vocal about his support for biosimilars, and he views a robust biosimilar market as critical to addressing the Trump administration's larger objective of bringing down drug prices, which Tom talked about before. Last summer, we saw the release of the agency's Biosimilar Action Plan, which focuses on improving efficiency of biosimilar development and approval, increasing scientific and regulatory clarity for development, ensuring that doctors and patients understand biosimilars and the role they may have to play in treatment, and then finally supporting market competition in general. The agency also released guidance on biosimilar labeling, guidance and Q&A on development, and guidance and Q&A on the biologics previously regulated as drugs for historical reasons, such as insulin and human growth hormone, that will ultimately transition to regulation as biologics in March of 2020. It was also a banner year for biosimilar approvals. There were 7 approvals last year. Now, keep in mind that only 9 biosimilars in total had been approved prior to last year, so we're certainly starting to see a major shift here. Additionally, of the 7 that were approved last year, 4 have already launched. That more than doubles the number of biosimilars that are now commercially available in the U.S. As for what's to come in 2019, based on publicly available information, there are 5 biosimilar submissions with action dates this year, plus at least 1 that's going through a second review cycle at FDA. There are also upwards of 70 products enrolled in FDA's biosimilar development program. So again, we are certainly going to see an uptake in the biosimilars market this year. Aside from additional biosimilar approvals, We're also expecting clarity from FDA on interchangeability, with the agency expected to release final guidance by this May. And FDA Commissioner Gottlieb has committed to the development of what he refers to as a structured interchangeability application. As you may know, we've yet to actually see an application or approval for an interchangeable biosimilar, and the expectation is that with the guidance and with a new application, that those things will in fact facilitate development. Among other things, the interchangeability final guidance may address whether manufacturers could use foreign versions of reference products in their clinical switching studies that are required for an interchangeability determination. That was one of the controversial topics that was not addressed in the draft guidance and that we expect to see some movement on in 2019. We're also expecting more biosimilar developers to pursue what are called carve-outs this year, and that's where the manufacturer would seek approval for some but not all of the reference product's indications, omitting the indications that are protected by market exclusivity or patent. That's quickly becoming a trend as a practical matter, but unlike the Hatch-Waxman framework for drugs, where there's a statutory mechanism and a regulatory process for carving out protected indications, there's no such clarity for biosimilar manufacturers. FDA has committed to issuing policy in 2019 so that manufacturers can really understand how the carve-out process works, and perhaps just as important, how the process would work to add those indications back in once patent or exclusivity had expired. Overall, we expect this year to be a really significant one in biosimilar development and approval, and it's likely that the biosimilar landscape will look drastically different when we meet again here next year.
Thank you, Kelly. Let's turn to product communications. We saw a modest uptick in OPDP and APLB warning and entitled letters in 2018. What are the key themes you think will emerge from those letters, and what do we know about where FDA might be headed in terms of ad promo regulation?
Well, as you know, warning and entitled letters issued by OPDP and Appleby have sharply declined in recent years. We used to see several dozen letters issued each year. 2018 saw 8 in total, 7 from OPDP and 1 from Appleby, but this is up from 5 total in 2017. So I'm not planning to discuss the letters in detail today, but there are certainly a few notable developments. First, the agency continues to focus on minimization or omission of risk and appears to be particularly focused on products with boxed warning. As a result, it's absolutely critical that manufacturers convey risk information appropriately, ensure fair balance, and share any material limitations to the indication or use of the drug, especially where the labeling contemplates that serious safety issues may result. Second, FDA continues to be concerned about promotion of investigational drugs, and last year called out one manufacturer for alleged inappropriate safety and efficacy claims on a product website and also at an exhibit booth at a scientific conference. Even with the historical decline in letters that we've seen over recent years, FDA's attention to investigational drugs has never really waned. And accordingly, it's important that any communications about investigational drugs clearly disclose that the product has not been approved. Moreover, while it may be appropriate to share scientific information or data about an investigational product or use, provided that the information is objective and straightforward and presented in a neutral way, it's very important to refrain from any claims or characterizations about that data that would veer toward promotional language. And finally, of course, it's important to refrain from implying that FDA approval is ultimately certain. Third, the agency, for the first time in many years now, issued an untitled letter that called a company out for off-label promotion. There, a company sales rep had given a presentation that allegedly promoted a drug for an off-label use in young children, including in babies. The product at issue had a boxed warning with very serious risks, including homicidal ideation, and it's likely that the vulnerable patient population here, as well as a serious risk, factored into FDA's decision to issue the letter. This letter also serves as a teachable moment because it focused on the oral statements of a sales rep to a physician. So we're aware of many companies that are now using this untitled letter to refresh its sales reps on promotional compliance. In terms of what this all means and what's to come in 2019, we've heard now from a number of FDA and DOJ officials that the government is mindful of First Amendment limitations with respect to regulation of manufacturer speech, and that rather than focusing on what FDA would refer to as a technical regulatory violation, the government instead is going to be focused on communications that are false or misleading or that otherwise implicate genuine safety concerns. Now, that's not to say that the government is no longer concerned with off-label communications, but the risk is certainly higher where off-label communications pose a real public health threat. We expect that approach to be borne out in the FDA letters again this year.
Thank you, Kelly. I mean, Tom mentioned earlier in the teleconference that CMS had proposed a rule that would require drug manufacturers to include the quote-unquote list price in broadcast television advertisements. Can you talk briefly about what the rule would mean for drug manufacturers and how we might see TV ads change in 2019?
Sure. So as Tom mentioned, CMS proposed a rule in fall of last year that was framed as an initiative by the government to combat rising drug prices. And in that proposed rule, CMS would require all drug manufacturers to disclose the list price, or the WAC price, in direct-to-consumer ads that are broadcast on television. The government's rationale was that by providing the price, both doctors and patients would have essentially a jumping-off point to have a conversation about costs, potentially engage in conversations about price shopping and comparisons to alternative therapies. And finally, there was a name and shame element here, because for companies that did not comply with the CMS rule, CMS would publish, presumably on a website, a name of all those companies. So the proposed rule, as you may expect, was hugely controversial when it was issued for a few reasons. Number one, list price is not tethered to the actual out-of-pocket cost that consumers pay, and in most cases, list price is significantly higher than what consumers actually pay. So the concern from industry and others is that the rule would in fact deter patients from seeking care and filling the prescriptions because they were misled about the potential cost. There was also a concern that the information just by providing list price alone would be misleading because there would not be enough context for consumers or doctors to understand how the average price would shake out for consumers and what alternatives could mean in terms of price comparison. There were also constitutional issues associated with the proposed rule. So the First Amendment case law provides that the government can only compel speech, as is compelled in this case, if the speech itself is factual and uncontroversial. And for the reasons that I've just been describing, many believe that the compelled disclosure of list price does not fit the bill. There are also issues associated with CMS's statutory authority to promulgate the rule. Interestingly enough, very shortly before CMS proposed the rule, PhRMA had issued or updated its voluntary principles for direct-to-consumer communications. In the PhRMA principles, members voluntarily agree now that in all DTC branded communications on TV, that they will direct patients where to find additional information about the cost of medicine. On that additional information, which presumably would be on a product or company website, would provide the list price, just like in the proposed rule, but would also provide information on the average, estimated, or typical cost for patients, as well as other context about potential costs of medications. So PhRMA and its members have voluntarily agreed to provide more information than what CMS would require, but the idea is that this additional context, because it doesn't all have to be included in the body of the television advertisement itself, would actually help consumers and doctors make more educated decisions without deterring patients from seeking care.
Thanks very much for those insights, Kelly. For the remainder of the teleconference, we're going to focus on enforcement. So let's turn it first over to Beth Wyman, who'll be talking to us about FDA enforcement. Beth, where do you think FDA and DOJ will focus their Food, Drug, Cosmetic Act enforcement resources and attention in 2019?
Sure. Well, in some ways, that's an easy question because we heard directly from FDA and DOJ leadership back in December at FDLE's annual enforcement conference. There, the commissioner, FDA's chief counsel, Stacey Klein-Amin, and DOJ's Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Consumer Protection Branch, James Burnham, laid out their enforcement priorities. As people on the line may know, DOJ's Consumer Protection Branch is the part of Maine Justice that has jurisdiction to enforce the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, both civilly through seizures and injunctions, and criminally. At that conference, the chief counsel suggested that FDA's focus in the coming year would be somewhat wide-ranging, focusing on tobacco, sales to youth, particularly vaping, opioids, compounding, food safety, and high-risk devices, primarily she spoke about duodenoscopes. The commissioner added rogue stem cell outfits and bad actors in the dietary supplement space to that list. And James Burnham focused on, among other areas, opioids, compounding, and general CGMP enforcement as priorities. I'm going to talk about what seems to be the intense focus on manufacturing practices I think we'll be seeing in the coming year, both for compounders, who are very much in the spotlight, and for traditional drug, device, and biologics manufacturers. As folks are likely aware, compounded drugs are not FDA approved. They are not subject to pre-market review for safety or effectiveness, and for a very long time, most compounders were not inspected by FDA unless something bad happened. And then something very bad did happen. The fungal meningitis outbreak in September 2012 that sickened hundreds and killed more than 70 patients was tied to a contaminated steroid injection that was produced at the New England Compounding Center. The country learned about entities that were compounding on a massive scale with little to no federal oversight and were shipping products all over the country, thus multiplying the risk of harm from poor manufacturing practices. And a lot changed after this outbreak. The Drug Quality and Security Act was enacted in 2014, and that act clarified what entities would be treated as traditional state-regulated 503A compounding pharmacies, and the act created a new category of facilities referred to as 503B outsourcing facilities. These outsourcing facilities are entities that compound or repackage drugs, but not pursuant to patient-specific prescriptions, and typically on a much larger scale than a mom-and-pop pharmacy. Since the enactment of the DQSA, these 503B outsourcers, like traditional manufacturers, are required to register with FDA and comply with CGMP requirements, and they are now subject to FDA inspection. I'll note that in 2018, FDA issued 176 drug-related warning letters. 88 of those addressed manufacturing practices, and nearly a fifth of those 88 targeted compounding pharmacies or outsourcing facilities. In addition, in 2018, the government brought two civil injunction actions resulting in consent decrees against outsourcing facilities. Those were Delta Pharma and Cantrell Drug Company. Both of those outsourcing facilities were processing, manufacturing sterile injectables in violation, allegedly, of CGMPs and, according to the publicly available documents, under unsanitary conditions. Expect to see more on this front in the coming year. In addition, we saw in 2018 the AmerisourceBergen criminal and civil settlements. I won't talk a lot about them, except to say that though this involved pre-DQSA conduct, the case involved manufacturing practices, sterile injectables, cancer support drugs that were being repackaged in an unregistered facility and under conditions that publicly available documents suggested were insanitary. The repackaging facility called itself a pharmacy, but the FDA saw it differently, and the charging documents charge the firm as a manufacturer. So while sterile injectables are front and center, James Burnham made it very clear that DOJ will also be looking to take enforcement action against all entities where manufacturing practices may have the potential to cause serious harm. So I think traditional drug, device, and biologics manufacturers are also very much on the government radar. Then I'll note on the device side that of the 26 device-related warning letters that went out in 2018, 20 of them dealt with CGMP violations.
Thank you, Beth. In addition to those trends, are there any specific legal cases that implicate the Food, Drug, Cosmetic Act that we should be keeping our eye on in 2019?
Sure. Before I do that, I want to note just a couple other priorities that I didn't get to. I'll do that very quickly. DOJ focused also on fraud. They said they're looking at practices that will hurt people. I think that covers the GMP practices, but also I think the fraud component covers data integrity issues, so I want to make sure to mention that, and also attempts to sort of evade FDA scrutiny. And I think Kelly talked a lot about marketing practices in sort of the administrative context. James Burnham spoke in December about marketing practices cases very directly, along the same lines as Kelly mentioned. He noticed the First Amendment problems with sort of truthful speech, But he did say that DOJ will be focusing on false and misleading speech, and specifically in cases where there's significant public risk. So I think, like in the warning letter context, we will likely see on the drug side, boxed warning cases, REMS cases, where there's sort of a minimization of risk or an ignoring of the REMS requirements. On the device side, I think risk and patient injury will be the driving force, both in the enforcement and the marketing practices side and otherwise. And I just want to take a moment before we get to the cases to watch to mention the rogue stem cell outfits that the commissioner alluded to. We've seen a number of warning letters and two injunction actions filed against those entities in 2008, and the commissioner promised a lot more activity on that front in the coming year. So if we want to talk about cases to watch, I will keep my eye on the stem cell injunction cases. I think these cases are fascinating. I will. They're very, very similar, so I'll just focus on one of them, and that is the injunction case filed against the U.S. Stem Cell Clinic, Inc. Out of Florida. The other case is the California Stem Cell Treatment Center. Sorry, did I say out of Florida? And the California Stem Cell Treatment Center is out of California. But these cases are, in some ways, almost identical. The U.S. Stem Cell Clinic case involves the marketing of unapproved stem cell treatments for a wide variety of serious diseases, including Parkinson's, ALS, COPD, and others. There's been actually a lot of press attention to this particular clinic after eye injections for macular degeneration led to a few patients becoming blind. And after that, the clinic stopped doing those injections, so they don't seem to be part of the injunction case, which is forward-looking. But this firm did receive a warning letter arising out of an FDA inspection that found that the clinic was taking adipose tissue, which is fat, from patients through a mini liposuction procedure and processing that, I know it sounds gross, but let's just ignore that for the moment, and processing that into what's called stromal vascular fraction, or SVF. That's a cellular product derived from the adipose tissue, and then the clinic would administer that product back into patients via IV or directly into the spinal cord. The inspection found that the processing of these injectable products was not being done in a cGMP-compliant sterile facility. So the injunction complaint rests on the theory that the clinic is adulterating and misbranding drug products while held for sale. Adulteration rests on the lack of cGMP compliance. The misbranding theory rests on the drug's lack of adequate directions for use. They are unapproved new drugs, so they de facto lack adequate directions for use. And the complaint hinges on the position that these products can, in fact, be regulated as drugs. Of course, the defense argument is going to be, no, these products are exempt from drug regulation. They are HCTPs, or human cell tissue or cellular or tissue-based products, subject only to statutory and regulatory provisions whose sole mandate is to control the communicable disease risks of these products. So in the clinic's view, FDA has no jurisdiction to regulate the products like drugs, and at issue in the cases will be the regulatory exemptions in Part 1271 of the CFR. We saw a similar case to this a few years ago, the Regenerative Sciences case. I think this case will deal with additional exemptions. The authority to go after these clinics is very high priority for the agency, and I expect we will see very motivated defendants arguing that this case reflects significant FDA overreach.
Thanks very much, Beth. It's very interesting, and we'll keep an eye on those cases and those trends going forward. Now let's take a broader lens on enforcement. I want to turn it over to Colleen Conry to provide her enforcement insights related specifically to the general topic of fraud and abuse, as well as opioids. Colleen, what trends have you seen in this area in 2018, and where do you think those trends will be particularly for DOJ in 2019.
Thanks, Al. So let me start with opioids first. So like many of the partner federal agencies, DOJ devoted substantial resources to addressing the nation's opioid crisis in 2018. Through both its criminal and civil enforcement actions, DOJ targeted a wide range of entities in the opioid space, including drug makers, suppliers, providers, and even distribution networks. So on the criminal side, DOJ has targeted these so-called pill mills, where health professionals allegedly distribute mass amounts of opioids for non-medical purposes. Also, in June, DOJ announced its largest healthcare fraud enforcement action in U.S. history, charging 162 defendants, including 76 physicians, responsible for prescribing and distributing more than 13 million illegal dosages of opioids. On the civil side, DOJ also hit some notable milestones. In August, DOJ obtained the first ever civil injunctions under the Controlled Substances Act, barring doctors who illegally prescribed opioids from writing prescriptions. DOJ also intervened in FDA lawsuits against a major opioid manufacturer, Insys Therapeutics, which settled for $150 million. The department had earlier charged seven of the officers at Insys with, among other counts, racketeering and conspiracy to violate the anti-kickback statutes. So based on that, opioids surely will remain a top priority for DOJ in the foreseeable future. So shifting away from opioids briefly, let's look at recent FDA enforcement activity in other areas in the healthcare and life sciences space. Interestingly, if you look across all FCA activity, across all industries, FCA activity actually declined in 2018. It was the lowest it's ever been since 2009. But despite that overall decline, FCA recoveries in the healthcare and life sciences entities actually increased by more than $300 million from the previous year. As in past years, key TAM actions were the primary vehicle for FCA enforcement, constituting nearly 90% of the new FCA matters in 2018. Consistent with prior years, the government intervened in approximately 20% of those QTEM actions. So other notable takeaways from this year is that fact that pharmaceutical and biotech companies were the most common targets of FCA actions. The largest single FCA recovery in 2018 involved a $625 million settlement with one of the nation's largest wholesale drug companies, Amerisource Bergen, for allegations relating to illegal repackaging and distribution of cancer drugs. Drug makers' patient assistance programs also continue to draw DOJ scrutiny, most notably resulting in a $210 million settlement with United Therapeutics just at the very end of 2017. Providers, both large and small, were also common defendants. DOJ was particularly focused on cracking down on arrangements that violate the anti-kickback statute. And then finally, managed care remains an area of activity. For example, in the Medicare Advantage context, DOJ secured a $270 million settlement with DaVita for coding misconduct that took place among a physician group that DaVita had acquired in 2012. Litigation in this space against United Healthcare Group also continues. So based on this recent activity, healthcare and life sciences companies can expect to continue to be prime targets for FCA lawsuits in 2019. So just to wrap it up, I want to point to two more interesting issues that we should all be following in 2019. I want to start with the Granston memo first. So this was issued in 2018, and the memo provided a framework for DOJ to invoke a rarely used FCA provision to seek dismissal of non-intervened key TAM cases that conflict with the government's interests. In November, DOJ first signaled its willingness to seek dismissal in an amicus brief to the Supreme Court. Last month, DOJ went further and moved to dismiss 11 key TAM actions, rejecting the plaintiff's novel anti-kickback statute arguments. These developments suggest DOJ may be more active in seeking similar dismissals in 2019. And then finally, Al, I think it's worth noting how courts continue to work through implications of the Supreme Court's landmark case, Escobar. In particular, the circuit courts continue to grapple with Escobar's materiality standard, which may soon prompt the Supreme Court to wade back in and provide additional clarity on that front.
That's great. Thanks for that overview, Colleen. We have a few minutes left, and we have a few questions that have come in from our listeners. So I want to use the expertise of the people around the room to help address those questions. First of all, Beth, you talked about a number of specific cases, but are there any cases percolating in the area of off-label promotion or marketing that people should be aware of?
Well, I mean, I guess we can think about the criminal convictions in July 2016 of Patrick Fabian and William Facto in connection with their marketing and distribution of a steroid delivery device that, according to the papers, was cleared only for use as a sinus stent that had saline elution capabilities, but was in fact distributed for unapproved uses. Those defendants were convicted on 10 misdemeanor adulteration and misbranding counts. And back in the summer of that trial in July 2016, at the end of the trial, the defendants moved for a judgment of acquittal or a new trial. That motion was fully briefed in the fall of 2016, but no decision on that motion has yet issued. So If 2019 is the year that the judge in the District of Massachusetts decides to rule, this will definitely be a case to watch. Both the government and the defendants will have the right to appeal to the First Circuit. This case involves significant First Amendment issues and will also likely involve the Park Doctrine.
Thanks, Beth. Questions come in for you, Tom, related to the whole challenge to the ACA. Any thoughts on whether the ACA could have been drafted or has been drafted such that the biosimilars title could be severable from the other more focused insurance provisions of the Act?
Well, I sure would have thought so. I mean, it's in a different title of the law. It's very hard to see how the individual mandate, and as a tax or not, has anything to do with the biosimilars pathway. So I would have thought that even if the individual mandate had to fall, that and some of the other titles of the ACA would have been severable. My best recollection of the principles of statutory construction are that when you're interpreting a statute, you're supposed to look first to congressional intent. And since Congress repealed or reduced the tax to zero but did not repeal any of the other provisions of the Act, one could think that Congress did not intend that result. But the Supreme Court is a wild card these days. We're not sure where this is going to end up. That would still be my suspicion, however.
Thanks, Tom. We have one last question. This is for you, Greg. Can you give us a quick overview of the development in the laboratory developed test debate, which has been ongoing for many years, but what's going to happen in 2019 from your point of view?
The action right now is in Congress, it seems to be. I mean, the FDA had, under the Obama administration, had moved forward with a proposal. They put forward a framework to begin regulating laboratory-developed tests. So the background, the 30-second background for those who don't know, is that tests that are developed – Colleen's pointing to herself. For those on the phone who can't see, so diagnostic tests that are developed within a laboratory, FDA's position has been that they have the authority to regulate those as if they were developed by a manufacturer and distributed and sold like test kits, but that they have chosen not to do that as a matter of enforcement discretion. But that over the years, these have developed from, you know, things that were developed within one lab and used within one lab, and people would send the samples in, and the lab would just run the samples on their tests that they developed within the lab and send out the results, to essentially mass-produced tests that are, you know, it's hard to tell the difference between that and something that's developed by a big test manufacturer, and that these things are now used for, you know, very high-risk diseases, and that given the importance of what's going on with personalized medicine and all genomic testing and all these things like that, the significance of that to medicine, that they think this is something that they need to begin regulating. And so beginning in 2010, actually, FDA said that they intended to start regulating these kinds of tests. By 2014, they'd come out with this framework to do so. But it was so controversial that by the end of the Obama's administration, the FDA couldn't get it done, and they kind of just threw up their hands and published a white paper and left it to the next administration to do. There was a bill that was going around Congress last summer. The FDA then came out with their own draft of legislation, which interestingly had a pre-certification type of model that was kind of similar in a lot of ways to this idea of pre-certification that they've been working on in the digital health or software area, so that a developer of a test, of what they're calling an in vitro clinical diagnostic test, if you got pre-certified by the FDA, you'd be able to get certain low-risk tests or potentially moderate-risk tests on the market without having to get FDA approval or maybe through some streamlined approval process. High-risk tests would have to go through FDA approval, and so there'd be different levels of tests. There's various exemptions in their proposal and so on for, orphan, tests for smaller groups of patients and things like that. So there's now – that idea has now been picked up and is in a bill that's been drafted that's being sponsored and drafted by Diana DeGette, who is on the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight Investigations, which has a lot of oversight over FDA and some others. Anyways, so I don't think it's been introduced in the current Congress yet, but of course nothing's been happening in the current Congress yet of consequence. So I think there's, you know, perhaps some chance that things can move on that front, but these days in Congress, who knows?
Thank you, Greg. That wraps up our teleconference. Thank you to my colleagues here today, Tom Bullitt, Kelly Combs, Colleen Connery, Greg Levine, and Beth Weinman. As I mentioned at the outset of the call, we are offering CLE credit for this teleconference. For those seeking CLE credit, you will need to fill out the attorney affirmation form that was included in the registration confirmation email you received yesterday. The CLE course code for this program is 3254. Once again, that is 3254. Please email the completed form to professionaldevelopment@ropesgray.com. Again, professionaldevelopment, all one word, @ropesgray.com, or fax it to 617-235-9606. Again, 617-235-9606 within 48 hours. We will continue to provide additional news and analysis about regulatory and enforcement issues emerging from the federal government throughout 2019. You can access that information by visiting our Capital Insights page at www.ropesgray.com. Once again, thank you for your participation and a good afternoon.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now all disconnect.